This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Just 10 years ago, scientists told me melting the world's ice system would take thousands of years. Since then, with the shocking ice loss at both poles, we're not so sure. Maybe abrupt climate change is possible. We're about to explore what can happen within one lifetime that has already happened in the ancient past. To find the clues, we'll dig into the seabed with a founding expert in the field. Our guest is recognized as the father of that science called paleoceanography. He started publishing in the 1960s. He wrote the standard college textbook Marine Geology, and he founded a journal on this subject. Dr. James Kennett is Emeritus Professor of Marine Geology and Paleoceanography at the Earth Science Department at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Dr. Kennett, it's an honor to welcome you to Radio EcoShock.
Well, I'm pleased to be here.
Why don't we start with the longer-term view of deglaciation and then work towards your surprising discovery? Was I right to say that a while ago, scientists thought major changes to the cryosphere would take thousands of years?
That's correct. The paradigm, if you like, many years ago, before the 80s really, was that glacial and interglacial oscillation, you know, ice ages and interglacial oscillations were gradual, pretty gradual. The transitions were taking about many thousands of years. And that was the paradigm. It was being primarily driven by oscillations of the Earth, geometry in relation to the sun, and therefore pretty predictable. And even in the 70s, there was a suggestion based on this paradigm that the Earth would be going into cooling, which was actually reasonable. That was the case. But in the 80s, especially the late 80s and on to the present time, what happened was a series of sequences were obtained, initially in the Greenland Ice Sheet, and then here in Santa Barbara, California, in the Santa Barbara Basin. Another one in Cariaco off Venezuela. A few critical sections were obtained through good technology, and these provide a high-resolution or high-fidelity record of climate change as measured in the atmosphere in the Greenland and as measured in the ocean in a place like Santa Barbara. And big surprises emerged was that it was found that very large climate changes, both warming and cooling, not just warming, occurred in decadal, centennial timescales. So major changes can occur in like 5 degrees centigrade, which would be about 10 degrees Fahrenheit, which is huge, could occur in just a few decades. And this is all well accepted. I mean, this is not even debated now in the scientific community. It's well accepted, but the big questions, of course, and it's still one of the major earth science problems of these times, is what are the triggers and what are the feedbacks, the climatic feedbacks, that are driving this incredibly rapid climate change at times. And that has not been adequately answered yet. It's a huge and interesting question. And, of course, with the ongoing global warming, it's understanding what triggers are and what the feedbacks are is paramount to trying to predict what's going to happen with warming in the future. That is anthropogenically caused. So that's the sort of a brief analysis of where we are.
Now, in your paper, you talked about two cycles that I noticed. One was a 700-year period, which is pretty short in geologic time, and then a 50-year period. Let's start with the 700-year period. What did you find was happening in that amount of time?
Not a lot. Basically, just some gradual warming. In other words, there's a background. What we see in the record is during these transitions between glacials and interglacials, in other words, from the ice ages into a warm period like we live in now, there's some gradual warming. But superimposed on that gradual warming are these sharp jumps. And as you say, there's like 700 years. Yeah, there's some gradual warming, not terribly significant, but in a general warming trend. But then superimposed in that trend is these remarkable jumps, like the one we just published about. We can get about a 5 degree centigrade, which is about 10 degrees, almost 10 degrees Fahrenheit, enormous jump in about 50 years, half a century, one lifetime, one human lifetime. And we've known this sort of thing is for some time based on younger records that we've studied, both in Santa Barbara and the Greenland Ice Sheet. But again, it come back to this major question, what on earth are the triggers that can suddenly drive the Earth, this climate system, that quickly? in, you know, less than a century. And this is not uncommon. I mean, basically, the record is full of these sharp jumps. When you look at the geologic record, when you go back and look and see what has happened in the past, and of course that has become quite important because in order to try to predict where we're going with global warming, with global change now, we'd love to know what may happen in 100 years, 50 years, whatever, 200, 300 years. And of course that comes down to this crucial question, what are the triggers and what are the feedbacks that are doing this? And that's something of a question still.
Well, I guess this is what we talk about when we talk about tipping points. I mean, things can proceed along a certain direction for a while, and then climate sensitivity turns out to be greater than we thought, and things sort of fall off the edge.
Well, exactly. One thing we have learned in the last few decades is just how sensitive, in fact, in the last 20, 30 years, just how sensitive the global climate system is. These tipping points or thresholds occur, but it still comes down to the fundamental scientific question: what is causing the threshold? What is causing the tipping point? You see, that's the key. There's some physical process on Earth that is actually causing that sharp change to occur. That's what I mean by these rapid climate change.
Well, let's journey back in time to about 631,000 years ago when your study published in October 2015 in the journal Paleoceanography was published. There were humans on the planet, mostly we assume in warmer Africa. I wonder what Earth would have looked like before and after this rapid transition.
I mean, basically, that transition we're talking about at 620,000 years ago, that's a transition. That's what we call a deglacial episode. In other words, before that occurred, the Earth was deep in an ice age. And then it transformed during that what we call a deglacial into a interglacial warming. And that amounted to melting of major ice sheets in the Northern Hemisphere, particularly over North America and Europe. That's a deglaciation. The ice sheets are melting dramatically. Sea level is coming up rapidly. But what we have learned is that looking at that particular deglaciation 620,000 years ago, that occurred, okay, it took 700 years overall, but most of the changes in that period, most of the warming that occurred during that deglaciation occurred in only three steps. The first one, which amounted to well over half of the temperature rise of the Earth, occurred in 50 years. Again, that particular one we published on just recently is not unique. That's the style of climate change that the Earth has been experiencing for probably the last 700,000 years or even a million years. So we're not talking about abnormal, anomalous behavior here. This has been the trend.
But I'm sure some listeners are wondering, how is it possible that a sample of seabed from sunny Santa Barbara can tell us anything about the state of global ice?
Very much, because we run various measurements in the section. Okay, the first point is that the Santa Barbara Basin sedimentary record happens to be one of, if not the highest fidelity climate record in the global ocean, anywhere in the world's ocean. So you get sediments deposited pretty rapidly in the Santa Barbara Basin, and you have a beautiful record of parameters or proxies that we can measure, both geochemical and paleobiological proxies, that we can actually measure the amount of temperature change in the ocean. And that, through much work over the last several decades, that is actually recording a global signature. It's not just local. This is actually recording climate change on broad scales of the Earth. We know that because we can correlate, for instance, all of these little and large changes in climate that we can record in the Santa Barbara Basin, both warmings and coolings, in high detail with the equivalent record of warmings and coolings measured in the ice in the Greenland ice sheet. So that shows that what we're experiencing here is in fact global. And there were various sophisticated geochemical approaches that we use. We use oxygen isotopes, we use carbon isotopes. We use paleobiological proxies. We use a whole range of different kinds of geochemical tools to unravel what's happening in the climate globally. obviously in Santa Barbara Basin, we can't directly measure the melting of an ice sheet because we're too far away from the ice sheet, but we can interpret the climate change that's associated with that melting of the ice sheet.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, talking with Dr. James Kennett, a specialist in the study of seabeds. He's from the University of California, Santa Barbara. Jim Kennett, what do catastrophic events in Yellowstone Park have to do with the research you published in October?
It's a good question. We're writing a paper on it now, another paper, and we hope to get it done this year. Basically, it's about 620,000 years ago, it just happens to be that the Yellowstone caldera formed. In other words, that huge volcanic caldera that we call Yellowstone blew out catastrophically. And it formed this caldera, this volcanic caldera that many people have visited, the big hole in the ground, if you like. And that caldera up there at Yellowstone is the top largest volcanic caldera known on Earth. The other is Toba in Indonesia. There's Toba and there's Yellowstone. Those are the two biggest known volcanic calderas of the last 25 million years. So it's a bigger volcanic event when that blew out. It blew out ash over that covered much of North America, and the ash was transported atmospherically down by through winds down to Santa Barbara. We get layers there. We get ash layers. We can geochemically fingerprint the ash as being derived from Yellowstone, from that actual blast out in Yellowstone. And so the question that arises, of course, is with such a large volcanic eruption, would there have been a volcanic winter? In other words, there was so much dust and associated chemicals in the atmosphere, sulfates in the atmosphere, that this would have caused a volcanic winter. In other words, a darkness for several years. And so what we did is we looked at the climate record on a 10-year resolution between samples across this event. And to make a long story short, we discovered that the caldera blast out consisted of two blast outs. There were two, and they were separated by 200 years. So there was one massive explosion, and then the 200-year lull, and then there was another massive explosion. And believe it or not, both of those explosions led to immediate cooling of the northern hemisphere, as recorded in Santa Barbara Basin, by 3 degrees centigrade each. That's about 6 degrees Fahrenheit in the history of the climate. So we have two volcanic winters. And those volcanic winters the volcanic winters took place in less than 10 years. Well, our resolution's only 10 years. So they probably occurred in 1 or 2 years, but we don't have that resolution. And the first volcanic winter caused climatic feedbacks, that made that cooling last 80 years. So that was an 80-year cooling. And the second one, the feedbacks were even larger, and that lasted 200 years. So there we are. We know pretty surely that that volcanic episode there did have a very large effect on, an immediate effect on global climate. But in that case, it was cooling, not warming.
Now, some of our listeners are deeply worried about more global warming methane being released in our current climate shift, and your paper talks about, quote, repeated discharge of methane from methane hydrates associated with both ocean warming and low sea level. Did that methane erupt from the west coast of North America or from the Arctic?
We don't know. The methane signature of increased methane, that signature we're seeing in the Santa Barbara Basin, is local methane. That particular methane is coming from the disassociation of methane hydrates or frozen methane on the seabed or in the seabed locally on the Southern California margin. And that methane is not coming from the Arctic. So the point is, what we're seeing here in Santa Barbara Basin is it's a keyhole, if you like, into how the system's operating. And I've got to say that I've worked on gas hydrates, which are frozen methane on the ocean margins. I've worked on those now for some years, and I have to say that I'm extremely concerned about our ongoing global warming and warming of the oceans. That definitely is going on right now, warming of the oceans. I'm worried about how the gas hydrates are going to play out in this process. I generally am very concerned about the potential role of gas hydrates as a major climate feedback that will exaggerate ongoing global warming. And that's a potential trigger. That's one of the potential triggers that can cause these tipping points. We can get a very rapid jump in global warming when you get a major feedback coming in associated with widespread disassociation or destabilization of the gas hydrates on the ocean margins. I don't know if the listeners will be familiar enough about gas hydrates, but the record that we have in Santa Barbara Basin is strongly suggesting that gas hydrates in the past have played a significant role in these rapid global warming episodes.
Well, moving to another topic, I've just spoken with three scientists about possible shifts in plankton as the seas warm. What can we learn about ocean productivity from previous warm ocean events?
Quite a bit. Again, it comes down to how high the resolution is that one is measuring. But again, there are some pretty good geochemical and paleobiological proxies for past changes in ocean productivity, of the plankton, of the surface ocean plankton. And these are being conducted in different parts of the oceans by numbers of scientists. It's one part of the package, really, is to just understand just how much and what the change in distribution of productivity is in the ocean with climate change.
I wonder what climate modelers like David Archer will think after his book, The Long Thaw. Is there still disagreement in the scientific community about how fast deglaciation can take place?
I don't think so. I don't detect a lot of disagreement about what I talked about just earlier, that there are these episodes of very rapid climate change, these so-called tipping points you mentioned. It was well demonstrated by these high fidelity records that it actually did occur. So, again, I'll repeat, during some of these major climate transitions, there is a general warming to cooling or cooling to warming, whichever direction one's going. But superimposed on those are these rapid changes. So, yes, there are general oscillations from warm to cold, from cold to warm, and so forth, going on and on. But superimposed on those are these rapid changes. And the key question is what, as I come back to what I talked about before, was what's triggering these? And I would say that one of the things we need to look at is gas hydrates. Now, I'll give an example of what we're seeing now coming out in the literature from the good scientific work. There was a recent paper from the University of Washington of methane plumes coming up from the seabed off British Columbia and Washington, Oregon. And that what they've concluded is that these are new, that these methane plumes are new in the last 20 years, maybe 10. And they didn't exist before, but they're new. They've been activated. And they're pluming up through the water column from the ocean floor. And the argument is that there's been a 0.3 degree centigrade change in bottom water temperature in this region at about 400 meters water depth. And they argue, and it seems reasonable to me, that this relatively mild warming, it's equal to about 1 degree Fahrenheit, has begun to disassociate the gas hydrates on the margin up there off the northwest North America. And that, to me, is a real concern. We're seeing it in other places. Even the Gulf Stream has been warming up. And so there's evidence of recent disassociation of hydrates along the margin of the southeast U.S., adjacent to where the Gulf Stream is coming north. There's a paper on that. And also the major concern, of course, is in the Arctic, with what's happening with the methane and the permafrost and on the shelf. And also in the deeper slope.
But you know, when I look at what happened at the Paris Climate Conference talks and in other policy settings, people aren't talking about abrupt climate shift. Is this something policymakers need to consider as remotely possible, likely, happening now? What's your opinion?
Oh, I think yes. The Paris Conference did not consider these potential triggering points, but I think it's one of my major concerns, is that needs to be strongly taken into consideration as to what are some of these potential feedbacks, rapid feedbacks in the future with ongoing global warming. Basically, the position was that the changes will occur like 2 to 3 or 2 to 2 or 3 degrees centigrade warming, but they have not considered the potential of parts of the system coming in and exaggerating the ongoing warming. I wouldn't say it's conclusive, but I'd say it's a reasonable hypothesis to seriously consider. And in general, the scientific community has not been doing that.
We've been speaking with one of the founders of the science of paleoceanography, the study of the seabed. Dr. James Kennett has published hundreds of papers. He's a professor emeritus with the University of California in Santa Barbara. Jim, thank you so much for all your work and for talking with us today.
Thanks for the opportunity. I've enjoyed it.
Find links to this paper, to Dr. James Kennett, and the topics we've talked about in my weekly EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info. I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.